This is The Platform Rules, Digital Transformation for Product Companies, hosted by Propel.
In rule number 6, learn the key success factors, Hostario Ambrosini goes into the obstacles derailing digital transformation success and how you can overcome them with guest Bruce Richardson. Bruce joined Salesforce in October 2011 as the company's first chief enterprise strategist. He's currently part of the market strategy team inside the product development organization, where he focuses on new opportunities outside of the traditional CRM markets, including ERP, supply chain management, and product lifecycle management. This is a great conversation for all those transforming their organizations right now. Here is rule number 6 of the Platform Rules.
Bruce, thank you for joining me today.
Dario, my pleasure. Anything for the team at Propel.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you for that. So we're going to chat about digital transformation today. And my personal thoughts on this have evolved. It felt like it was a buzzword that was overused, but more and more we're seeing companies coming to us and they're really interested in completely changing their tech stack and modernizing. You see way, way more of this than I do, especially with larger enterprises. So what are your thoughts on digital transformation?
You know, it's funny. When you invited me to do this, all I could think about was that famous Mike Hammer Harvard Business Review piece, and then the book that came out. The Harvard Business Review piece came out in 1990, and the book Reengineering the Corporation, a Manifesto for Business Change in 1993. And I remember back to those days. I had recently started at AMR Research, and the whole world looked like it was exploding. We didn't call it digitization then, it was business process reengineering. And you know, for those listening in or watching us, they may remember those days. First of all, there was an explosion in tech. The mainframe was suddenly everybody's enemy and the whole world was going to client server, despite the fact that no one knew how you were going to manage thousands or millions of PCs out there on a network. How are you going to secure them or administer them for that matter? There was the sudden push to Unix, even though it was only had a small market share at the time from proprietary operating systems. We were all going to relational database technology, although not a lot of people knew what that was. So there was excitement about technology. The second thing that happened was the idea that we were going to reorganize all the business processes, because at the time, you didn't have an ERP vendor. You had to buy all these specialty apps and then you had to glue them together. Or worst case is you sat there with two terminals, one connected to one system, and then you had to log into another system to be able to do your job. We didn't have any of the things that we have today. And then I'd say the last thing that happened was, you know, the emergence of ERP as the dominant business system. And the role that the big consultants played. You know, the big consultants were never that big until ERP came around. Then the largest firms they'd go in and convince the C team that they needed to look for a new business system to replace all those silos. So they'd win the business to do the evaluation and then win again by getting to do the implementation, which in some companies, you know, people are in year 10 of a 3-year implementation and still happening today, 30 plus years later. If you take that analogy to where we are today, if you look at the tech, I mean, I think pretty much concede it's a cloud world. I saw a stat from Gartner saying that I think this year cloud's going to be a $500 billion business growing to $600 billion next year. That's not just applications. That's the infrastructure and everything having to do with it. We take for granted that critical components include AI and machine learning. We're experimenting with new ways of displaying data, whether it's tools like a Tableau or augmented reality or virtual reality, and you know some of the things that are emerging in Web3. We're looking at workflow and robotic process automation and tools like that. So the technology is a lot different than it was 30 years ago, but the goal is still the same. How do we leverage technology to get closer to customers, suppliers, constituents. So I think the goal is staying the same. It's just that we have more tools and it doesn't cost nearly as much as it did 30 years ago.
So that's great. So if you go back to 30 years ago, then, you know, the ERP dominant model, there was huge productivity gains that came from that. So I do you think that now the move to the cloud and this explosion in cloud, is it going to be the same step function in productivity or benefits that comes from this long-term transfer?
Well, I think it's, I mean, if you look at it, go back, look at some of the ERP vendors, and I won't name any names like SAP. Those systems were impossible to learn. You know, you either had to have too many people because no one knew the whole system, or you had to hire an army of specialists who were pretty expensive at the time that knew how to be able to run that stuff. Now, most people can sit down at an application and within a minute or so figure out how the application works because they've been exposed to it. You know, they've grown up having desktops. I mean, when I started in the tech industry, you know, yes, there were punch cards. Yes, we did use a lot of calculators. Nobody had a desktop. If you needed something done, I'm embarrassed to say you handed it off and someone typed it up for you and gave you a report. And then we saw the rise of word processing machines. I mean, my first job writing about the industry at Yankee Group, we had Wang word processing systems. They were basically dumb terminals. They were precursors to PCs. And now you look at what we have right at our fingertips. Everything's so much easier, but it's not perfect.
So is this ease of use and the adoption and just obviously easy to deploy, is this what's driving digital transformation? Is it just really driven by the end users who are demanding this, or is there something else here?
Yeah, no, I think everybody's demanding it because they want immediate access. They want people to immediately begin using it. I mean, you remember the old days, if you go back to the early days of ERP, you had to go and scope out how much processing power and how much storage and how much data you're going to be generating. Now everything's elastic. You don't worry about that stuff. You don't worry about running out of storage or compute power. It's all provided for you. The expectation is today that, hey, I buy a system from Propel or Salesforce, and I'm going to have people using it before the end of the week. Training, what training? Someone has already used one of our systems, yours or ours or both, and they sit down and go, hey, let me show you how to do this stuff. It's easier than you think. Boom. You know, within a week or two, they're generating reports and they're on the system as if they grew up with it.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. So let's switch gears a little bit. You talked about the technology 30 years ago, and earlier I read a stat, and I think it's been floating around for a while, but the stat says that since the year 2000, about half of the Fortune 500 have either gone bankrupt, they've been acquired, they've ceased to exist. And it just brings me back to the whole, when I go back 30 years ago, there was a big movement about the big older companies, they're too slow to adopt technology, they're going to be disrupted by, you know, these newer players. But now it feels different. What once some of the bigger cloud companies have become dominant forces themselves, so they are the ones driving technology change. But I see a lot more large companies that understand the fact that they need to modernize technology. They need to come at this a different way. But you work with some of the largest enterprise companies in the world. Do you see the same embrace of technology across the board, or are there still some larger companies that get it and others that are laggards?
No, you know, I think, let's say you put the customer first. Now you start with that as perspective. You say, how do I work backwards? How do I know everything about that customer? How do I target my marketing messages to them? Get my engineering team focused on building the products that they need. I think, you know, once you move from the constraints of an ERP system and started thinking about what would your environment look like if you put the customer or the product first, what would you work around that? And I think people are starting to do that. Also, you know, there was an awful lot of money spent. There's a Fortune 100 company. It might even be a Fortune 50 company. And I remember how they talked about how they had replaced, you know, eight or so separate instances of a big ERP system that everyone can guess which one it was. And it took up something like 10 years and $1 billion. And I'm thinking, wow, what if they had taken that money and invested in a whole new cloud infrastructure? Would they be way ahead of where all the competitors are in the industry? Was that the best place to spend money? Or are there other things that they should be looking at? I think the other thing that's happened too is, you know, boards of directors are a lot smarter about technology and get what it can do, because in their own personal lives, they're using all sorts of cloud-based tools to, whether it's, you know, email and calendaring functions or more sophisticated tools to help them keep track of everything that's happening at the various companies whose boards they sit on. They're just so comfortable using technology. They want to know, why aren't you moving more aggressively? You know, why don't you have a system that could be used globally and that could be rolled out immediately? And it's a, you know, very low cost of operation. If you look at, you know, the idea that in the past you had to have a center of excellence or a center of expertise to support that big ERP system, now you have a handful of people supporting the applications. There is no COE responsible for doing all of that. We can use, you know, the people that work for us to be able to manage all of that stuff. We don't need to go out and hire all these experts. We are the experts.
So easy to deploy, you know, faster, cheaper, better, all that's great. But one thing that you said earlier feels like it's still a bit of a sticking point. If you're going to put the customer at the center of what you're doing, not all of your systems and not all of your, you know, cloud solutions are going to connect to that. So if you're going to work backwards from there and go all the way into supply chain, into everything else that is touching, do you ultimately need to go down the path of an industry solution in order to put the customer at the center of the experience here?
You know, I think that's the way the whole industry's evolving anyways. You know, I think back to it where the ERP systems you bought in the early days were generic. They were a one size fits all thing. And in our case, CRM was as well. And then, you know, at least one of our competitors came up with industry versions. It might have been more superficial. You changed, you know, a tab or an object to reflect the terminology that might be used in the banking industry instead of, say, manufacturing, in terms of how you refer to a customer or an order or something like that. But I think people want a system that works more closely with the way they work. So they want to have all that industry functionality built in, and they want it to be deep and they want it to be real.
Fair enough. So thinking also back to the customer, going back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, you've got supply chain issues. It's been a mess for the past 2 years. You've got demand coming from customers. You know, is the ability to bring that demand forecasting back into your supply chain, into how you manage it, into when you order and how you order, is there an advantage here when you're embracing technology to do that, that companies really need to be thinking about?
Sure. I mean, Dario, take your own customers in the PLM space. They're using Propel. They've just designed a new product and are ready to launch it. The people on that team want to know, hey, with all of the chip shortages or whatever the components could be, it's a lot more than just chips. What are the lead times on this? What's the likelihood we're going to meet that launch target that we set if we don't have ample supply? What does demand look like? We have enough inventory coming in. Where is it? Is it stuck on a container ship that's off the port of Los Angeles or Long Beach? You know, when do we think that container is going to get here? Do we have any workarounds? Or if we're counting on suppliers, sadly, in Ukraine or Russia, we're not getting any products out of there. What can we do? Can we set up a little ad hoc task force to be able to search out alternate suppliers that are closer to where we're producing product? What can we do to be able to do that? And I think there's a lot of cloud-based tools that allow you to do that kind of collaboration and make you a lot more focused. But I think we all want to have access to information from other systems. We don't care where it is, as long as we have a single version of the truth. We don't care where it's located or what it's running on or what cloud it's on, but we want to be able to get access to that. And I think now we expect to be able to do that. It's not quite as seamless as I presented, but you look at some big companies like take Flex, for example. You know, they've got the Flex Pulse systems, which is managing all their global operations around the world. If they can save an hour of inventory or a day of inventory, it's worth $60 million to them. They are tracking everything that's happening in their operations, from finance, from purchasing, from sourcing, from engineering, from shipping, whatever it could be. They built this massive system to be able to do that. I see them as a model for where a lot of companies are going to go. Granted, their business is different. You know, they've got the margins of a supermarket, so they've got to be able to run their business really lean. But I always hold them up as a company that has really thought about this and could create the first, you're going to groan when I say this, but the first metaverse for supply chain operations, you know, minus the avatars with no arms and legs and, you know, the floating around. But the idea that you could have a virtual representation of your whole supply chain and have instant access to that data and what's going on, I think they're a role model.
Okay, we'll save the metaverse discussion for another podcast.
I just wanted to make you laugh, that's all.
But so you mentioned Flex, and I mean, their scale is enormous. So going back to when you mentioned, you know, one small savings for them can provide a huge economic impact. I don't think most companies have that lever. So what do you do if you're a little bit smaller, still big, but smaller, international, you know, name brands, but you don't have a team of 50 engineers to work on integrations. You don't have, you know, you can't put a tiger team on every problem. Are they approaching this in a fundamentally different way as, say, the largest companies like a Flex is?
Well, you know, I think what's happening in supply chain, everybody's an expert in supply chain. You know, you go to the supermarket and a product that you always want or that you always buy, and it's not there. You go into your favorite restaurant. For example, you know, this has been a big sports period with March Madness, the start of baseball, the playoffs in the NBA, all of that. And say you go into your favorite place and you want to have a beverage and a snack. I defy you to find chicken wings anywhere in the United States that resemble the chicken wings that you know. Or, you know, other things. In weird industries, the trucking industries, they can't get enough tires. The home construction industries, they're having a problem getting garage doors. So this supply chain shortage is everywhere. And I think what we're doing is we're trying to tackle the problems as they occur. And maybe we should have been doing a digital twin idea that says, what if, you know, this COVID situation gets a lot worse and shuts down Shanghai and all of our products are there. And that's where all the containers are waiting to be loaded and shipped back to the US. Or, hey, we produce all of our apparel and footwear in Vietnam. They just closed down for 2.5 months. What do we do on that? So I think this has been a test for real-time management in terms of, you know, sense and respond in terms of what we're doing. So I think we're all learning and we got a lot smarter over the last 2 years.
So I agree we're learning, and I hear lots of people like yourself talking about it. Are you seeing the next level down where the companies are actually acting on it? Are they thinking through these scenarios? Are they building alternative supply chain partners in order to tackle this?
Kind of yes and no. I mean, I saw an article, you know, just this morning that I had cut out of the Wall Street Journal from a couple of weeks ago. U.S. companies shift to Mexican suppliers, and it goes through, you know, there's a survey of 2000 U.S. and U.K. CEOs and, you know, what percent are going to do nearshoring or onshoring. You know, we've been talking about that for 30 years, bringing manufacturing back to the U.S.
Yeah.
And it rarely happens. Yeah, maybe we are looking for suppliers that are closer because we don't want to be held hostage by geopolitics or events beyond our control. But I think, yeah, in some cases it's more talk. And you also have to remember, in some of these big companies, some of the small companies, there's still a lot of politics. Hey, that's my domain. I got that under control. So we like to think of sort of this transparency and the ability to work across, you know, all departments and groups and business units. In the real world, it doesn't really happen like that. People can be very territorial.
Yeah, we see that a lot. So that goes me into the next line that I want to get into. Would love to hear your thoughts on advice and best practices. To your point, companies move at different paces. You've got politics, you've got people, there's always resistance. If you're in a company and you believe that digital transformation, modernization, latest technology, whatever we want to call it, but this is the path of the future, what recommendations do you have for these people on how to get their companies to adopt new technology and just make them much more resilient?
Well, you know, I think if you're going to do it inside your own company, you're going to have to really focus on the business value and really build a very strong business case to be able to do it. You're probably going to want to find some other renegades inside the company that are willing to build a prototype, you know, even if they're borrowing budget from another project to be able to say, hey, we did an internal hackathon and we built this in 2 weeks. Here's some of the stuff that can be done. But I'll give you an example. We were working with a very well-known consumer goods companies in the health and beauty aid space. I think they're was actually involving a shampoo product. And they had, I'm not going to give the actual numbers just to, you know, protect the innocent, but let's say they had 20 manufacturing lines that were running three shifts a day, 7 days a week. And they were collecting all of this data manually from the outputs from the machines at the end of every shift. They were entering all this stuff into spreadsheets. We showed them a way that they could store all of that data in the platform, and we turned them from data collectors to data analysts, and they could spend more time figuring out how to increase throughput, how to eliminate errors, remove any quality issues, things like that. This is a company with, let's say, 100 manufacturing plants around the world. Despite dramatic success at this one plant, it never got adopted anywhere else. So, I mean, I don't really have, I guess, a best practice for doing it, but I think you're always going to find really smart people that are going to figure out a workaround. And it's just a question of how do you get other people to listen to you or to become part of the great resignation and then do it at your next company.
Okay. So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like start small, prove it out, show the ROI. And if you can't get people to listen, it's time to find another job.
Well, yeah, it's funny when you repeat what I said, it sounds a lot harsher than what I was saying. I think there's some reception. It's certain areas like manufacturing or supply chain, there's always the sense that they don't have the budget to do all the things they know they have to do because the budget is going to marketing or whatever. So they can't always do the stuff that they want. And my only advice would be keep pushing. You mentioned the stat of the number of Fortune 500 companies that have, you know, disappeared over the decades, or actually, I think just since the beginning of the 2000s, it's been an enormous amount. And I know Ray Wong is talking about the number being even higher than it is now. I think he says 80% of the Fortune 500 could disappear between 2000 and I don't know if it's 2030 or 2025. Ray's a pretty provocative guy who's usually right. So I'm guessing it's more aggressive than not aggressive, but.
Yeah. And for the record, I have no problems with budgets going to marketing, just so just so we're aligned on that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Bruce. So last thing, for people who want more, you know, information on digital transformation, advice, do you have any go-to resources or any places that you think they should be looking to get, you know, to educate themselves and to find more, whether it's following you or anybody else like Ray, who you mentioned that they should be listening to?
Ray's a very clever guy. I have a copy of his book here, but I would say, check that out. He really thinks way ahead of everyone else. The name of the book is Everybody Wants to Rule the World, which will get you singing that song. Maybe Bianca can play that as the closing music as we wrap this up today. You know, Tears for Fears, which was a great album, Songs from the Big Chair.
Yeah, as long as with a title like that, it really is about technology and transformation and not about something more nefarious. So I'll have to check out that book, and I'm sure some of our listeners will as well.
Sounds great.
All right, Bruce, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
All right. Great to see you as always. I look forward to finally being able to get together in person. It's been a long 2+ years.
Sounds good. Take care.
All right. Thanks. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Platform Rules Digital Transformation for Product Companies. You can listen to this show and more at propelplm.com/podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard, please share with a colleague, leave a review, or email us at podcast@propelplm.com with any feedback or questions. Until next time, Platform Rules.